Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Michael. Thanks for coming out tonight. It's an amazing honor and a lot of fun to come back to show you what I've been working on, to share it with you. I'm really delighted to have this honor from the lead lecture. It means a lot, and I appreciate the people coming to see what I've been up to. It's started with Jim and ecology and demography, and then taking each of those pieces, as my friend Daniel Promislow said, going down the slippery slope of molecular biology. But all along, I've been trying to keep the big picture and hold the insect biology and the concepts together. And what I'm going to tell you about today are, if we can see this okay, are these models of aging research that have become prominent in recent years. Actually, it's really got going at the genetic level in the early 90s, about when I was doing my PhD. And one of the common themes that they found in them is regulation by insulin signaling has effects on aging. But the part of this that attracted me to that, we didn't really understand those details at the time, was a common pattern of torpor or diapause, or in the case of C. elegans, dour. And the notion that I'm going to be trying to emphasize over and over again is that there's longevity assurance, which is a process that can slow the aging process, and that there's plasticity for this, like there's for a lot of phenotypes, developmental or behavioral phenotypes. And what we're finding is that this plasticity is regulated by insulin signaling, but also by other hormones that insects have and that we think might be common, again, with mammals. So the story about this, then, is to try to focus on this plasticity of dour, diapause, or torpor, and then finally relate this back to mammals, and particularly humans, where I'll talk about at the very end. It's like, well, how does this work? Because humans don't have diapause or hibernation, unlike, let's say, mice. So the story begins, really, with the discovery of the DAF mutants. And the DAF mutants were characterized in C. elegans in the 80s, but it's not because of their effects on aging. It's because it's their effect on this dour phenotype that they undergo in the juvenile stage. And so they were doing a lot of mutagenic screens, finding mutants that constitutively would form dours or block dour formation, and doing a lot of epistasis analysis, figuring out which was upstream of which. But still, they hadn't cloned many of the genes, so they didn't even know what they were doing. So they just gave them names, DAF, dour formation, DAF1, DAF2, DAF3, DAF, you know, up to the numbers quite high. Now, there was a common observation among people working on this that was finally really nailed down by Cynthia Kennan and then Gary Rovkin, was that one of the DAFs, DAF2, if they don't undergo dour as larvae, when you get them into adults, they're long-lived. And that's what I'm showing you here. This is the percent survival of adults going to demography right off the bat, right? 100% survival, and this is going to be survivorship down to zero as a function of age. So you start with a big cohort in wild type, and everybody's using N2. This is their survival pattern. And this mutant here, this one particular allele that's commonly used in the field, is considerably longer lived. So this observation was known, but what really caught fire was when they cloned it. And this was cloned by Rovkin and by Kennan separately. And it turned out that this DAF2 encoded an insulin-like receptor. And then people said, insulin in aging? This was important. So that's the theme here. Well, I'll call this insulin, but it's also IGF, or IGF receptor, because flies and worms just have a single receptor. Unlike mammals, we have a separate IGF receptor and a separate insulin receptor. So I'll call it insulin IGF, or I might just slip into calling it insulin. But keep in mind, we can't make this distinction, really, in these invertebrates, because it has both kinds of functions. And from the epistasis analysis of dour as well, they could identify other genes in the signaling pathway, including the transcription factor DAF16, which we now know is a FOXO homologue. It'll play an important role in what I'm going to tell you about in Drosophila in a few minutes. And then intermediate stages, actually AGE1 was the first longevity gene that was discovered. This is, I think it's AKT. No, this is PI3 kinase, and this is AKT. So there's the insulin signaling pathway, DAF2, when it's mutant, extends lifespan. This requires DAF16, the transcription factor. There's intermediate stages that are involved. But at the same time, also with Dower, it was recognized that there's hormonal pathways, steroid hormone pathways, that are controlling Dower. And these also have effects on aging. And if they're mutant, you get long-lived worms. So it's a little more complicated than how it worked. And they didn't know what the hormones were. So they had this nuclear hormone receptor, DAF12 in particular. Here's a biosynthetic pathway that's P450, I believe. And it was only very recently that Adam and Teddy identified the hormone that's regulating this. They call it datochronic acid. And it's actually, it looks a lot like bile acid in mammals. So there's two pathways here. There's an insulin pathway and a steroid and related pathway that are regulating aging. And C. elegans. Well, those are details that fell out. But what was happening in my own work was I worked with Jim, I was working with Callus abrucus, I messed around with butterflies, grasshoppers, all kinds of stuff. And one of the things I was interested in butterflies was diapause. And this is Batisphilinor, the oversummering diapause. So being aware of this diapause phenotype, it occurred to me that Dower was a lot like insect diapause. And then when I became interested in Drosophila, I just asked, well, don't they diapause and how do they overwinter? And people really don't know. I mean, it's still kind of debatable, but I would say we do know for now for sure that what Drosophilids do is they overwinter as adults in a reproductive diapause state. So that's what I'm showing you here. And the question I asked was, okay, if this is associated with longevity assurance and C. elegans when they're mutants, is reproductive diapause sufficient to confer longevity assurance in Drosophila, and perhaps in any other insects? So the first kinds of questions I asked when I set up my lab at Brown was to try to ask, does reproductive diapause in Drosophila confer longevity assurance? If it does it work through insulin signaling? And are there other hormones that are involved? And one that I was particularly interested in was not steroid hormones, but juvenile hormone, because it's known that juvenile hormone regulates diapause states in a lot of insects. So this seemed to be an important place for me to look, and I'll be talking about work with that in a minute. So the first kinds of experiments we did was just to simply induce reproductive diapause in adult Drosophila and see if this slowed aging. And we did this with melanogaster. We had to mess around with photoperiod and temperature. So the way these experiments worked, I won't go into the details, but we could take flies that had been in diapause for 9 weeks, and then age them alongside flies that were 9 weeks younger, newly enclosed. And now I'm showing you the mortality rate, not the survivorship. So this is the death rate. And you can't tell these apart. So even though these are 9 weeks old, after you take them out of diapause, they behave as if they hadn't aged at all. So that said, yeah, this stops aging, it slows it. These are endemic species, Triaroya from Japan, Litoralis from Northern Europe. These are just photoperiod-induced diapause. And when we induce diapause, we get the blue line relative to the green. And to some extent, this also slows their aging. So diapause is sufficient to slow aging in Drosophilids. The other part of this, as I said, is a reproductive diapause. And this is where I saw this one paper, I'll show you on the left here, and I looked at this and I like almost fell out of my chair. Because in reproductive diapause, the ovaries shut down. They don't make any villigenic ovaries and ovarioles. They stop germline proliferation, and the ovaries are just these tight little grape, you know, clusters. And this juvenile hormone regulator. Well, there was a paper from 1996 that had described the first insulin mutants in Drosophila. And here's, I was looking at this, and here's the picture of wild type ovary. And then there, here's the picture of the insulin mutant. And you can't tell too well from this photograph, but these are identical. So I looked at this and I went, wow, the insulin mutants are in diapause. They have diapause-like ovaries. So there might be a direct connection from C. elegans with the Dower and DAF2 and insects with diapause and insulin signaling. And this led me then to pursue insulin signaling as a regulator of diapause and, not so much diapause, just of aging in Drosophila. So here's a little background, and these are data on insulin signaling has come out over about 15 years. And the important thing to know is a lot of the information that I'm going to show you on this slide in particular is because people study growth. So you can look for mutants that affect growth. And you can look for epistatic interactions that rescue the mutants that affect growth or enhance them. And in this way, by standard molecular genetics, you can dissect the signaling pathway, identify what the genes are. And in this kind of work, and this here is from genomics, we identified 8 different Drosophila insulin-like peptides. So not one insulin, but 8. That's not so bad. C. elegans has maybe 40. So we're lucky in that. But both of these species just have a single insulin receptor. And so it's DAF2 and C. elegans. Here's the mammalian insulin or IGF receptor. They're very similar. And Drosophila has just one tyrosine kinase receptor that fits this bill, and we call it INR. And then many years later, and it took about 10 years, people finally identified what the transcription factor was that was homologous to DAF16. It's a FOXO. It's called D-FOXO. And it's regulated as well by insulin, and it's required for the growth effects of insulin mutants. So now let's turn back to aging or demography. The first question we asked, and this was from very early on, I did the very difficult mutagenesis of picking up the telephone and saying, please send me the mutants that you had. But actually it was more difficult than you might think because the people who were working on this had sort of disbanded. And one of them was at Pfizer, and you know, you can't just pick up a phone number and find somebody at Pfizer to talk to. It was pretty hard to do. But once we got the mutants and we cleaned up the genetic backgrounds, we did demography with them. Again, this is survivorship as a function of age. The solid is the wild type. These are all now co-isogenic from back crossing. These are a bunch of heterozygotes. Here's a trans heterozygote of 2 mutants. They're short-lived. This is often what you get with insulin mutants. But there was one combination that was long-lived, and it has lower mortality rates than the controls. And it's this combination right here. And the specifics of what it means, I couldn't even tell you at the time because we couldn't identify what the mutations were. But we could show very clearly that some sort of a hypomorph of the insulin receptor was sufficient to extend lifespan in flies. Now we're going to come back to reproduction briefly. I showed you before some kind of gross pictures of the insulin mutant ovaries, but here's what a single ovarial looks like in an insulin mutant. They have a germarium, they have a few early stage egg chambers, and then no vitellogenic egg chambers. Here's another example of this. This is what the whole ovary looks like. But if we take one of these flies and treat it with some juvenile hormone, within a day or two, we get ovarials with fully vitellogenized eggs. So this is an insulin receptor mutant, but we can at least rescue, at least partially, the fecundity phenotype by treating them with juvenile hormone. When we went and measured what the juvenile hormone levels were, these are wild type levels. This is corpora that are isolated, and we're looking at generation of juvenile hormone in an ex vivo assay. From the mutant flies, they produce very little GH, some, but much less. So there's a connection then between the insulin mutants and juvenile hormone production. And then we could go on and show, actually, and this figure is in the original paper on this, and I'm probably the only person that talks about it or cites it, and I don't understand it very well, and you'll see why in a minute. If we took the insulin mutants, that's one of these out here, and we treat it with ethanol, does nothing. Here's all the control genotypes treated with ethanol or methoprene, does nothing. But this line here is the insulin mutant treated with methoprene, that one right there. And it rescues, it reduces the survivorship back towards wild type, saying there's something about these insulin mutants that involves juvenile hormone in the control of the lysine. What is it? How do we get at this problem? And one of the things you probably know because you're entomologists is for a long time, one of the problems with working with juvenile hormone in adult insects, especially Drosophila, you put methoprene on an adult Drosophila, it does nothing. Doesn't, you know, here it is. Doesn't shorten their lifespan. Doesn't increase their fecundity. It's been very difficult to even do mutagenic studies to figure out what juvenile hormone does using Drosophila as a model because they seem to be pretty resistant to it. So the approach we wanted to take, and it took a long time to get this to work, and this is with Rochelle Yamamoto in my group, was we knocked out the corporalata just in the adult. So this is the corporalata in the adult, and we figured out protocols with different types of basically necrotic induction. And we can knock this out, so we get viable adults, and then we get rid of the corporalata, and as you can see right here, the juvenile hormone levels go way down relative to all the controls. So now we have a juvenile hormone reduction fly. We're not trying to add GH, we're trying to take it away. And this works very nicely. This is fecundity. Let's look out here just at day 7 so we don't get saturated with all these other bars. But here's the fecundity of wild type. Here's wild type plus methoprene, does nothing. But nicely, the knockout flies, corporate lot of knockout, have reduced fecundity, and if we treat them with juvenile hormone, the fecundity goes back up. So now we have a system where we can take out GH and it has effects on fecundity like we might expect it to. So now we can ask, is juvenile hormone itself sufficient to control aging? And it is. This top panel here shows the two controls, and then this one is the corporate lot of, actually three controls. This is the corporate lot of knockout fly. Pretty substantial and reproducible extension of lifespan and survivorship. It's juvenile hormone dependent, because if we take the same kinds of flies and we treat the capo fly with methoprene, it drops the survivorship back towards the controls that are in ethanol, does nothing. So here's the capo fly with ethanol, it's long lived. Here's the capo fly with methoprene, it's like a wild type fly. So, taking away GH is sufficient to extend lifespan in Drosophila. And the last question, and this one goes way back to stuff that I was working with Jim, was, well, maybe this is trivial. Since they reproduce less, and reproduction induces costs of reproduction, reproduction increases mortality rates, decreases survivorship for mechanisms we don't quite understand, but it's a very robust relationship. Maybe because they're less fecund, they're longer lived. And that's simply that the juvenile hormone is mediating this trade-off between reproduction and lifespan. But that turns out not to be the case. We did the same experiment here where we put the capo, but now in an OVOD genetic background, which is sterile. So these flies do not produce eggs. The F1s that we're studying do not produce eggs. So there can't be any cost of reproduction because they're not making any eggs. And what you can see here is that taking away their juvenile hormone still extends their lifespan. So that tells us that GH is having an effect on aging that's working presumably directly on the somatic systems and is not being mediated, let's say, by resource allocation due to reproduction. So the model that we can come to from this is sort of the intermediate point of my talk today, is that where is insulin being produced in flies? Mostly in the brain, not exclusively. So the brain, and then the corporalata here, the brain, we've subsequently found this insulin is controlling juvenile hormone because the insulin goes into the corporalata, and that's a regulatory step. But also the insulin goes past that and goes into circulation. The juvenile hormone can be secreted, of course, from the corporalata. And so now we have both of these hormones regulating reproduction, presumably cell and systemic stress responses, and definitely metabolism. And the way I look at this is going back to this idea of torpor, is that the flies have a plasticity. They could be in a reproductive state that happens to be pro-aging, where they're reproductive, very active metabolism, and there's active repression of stress response systems. And I think it's because there's a conflict in getting these two kinds of activities to work at the same time. So high fitness here when the environment is good. But change the environment and the flies can adopt a syndrome of longevity assurance where reproduction is turned off directly through these pathways, metabolism changes or is reduced, and then stress responses and longevity assurance systems are turned on. And these are regulated by these hormones, and I think it works this way because this is part of the natural life history of Drosophila and other insects. So this is kind of a big picture, but the question, you know, to prove this and to figure out, okay, yeah, what are these systems here, or here, or here, that confer these two different states, and how are they coordinated? To answer this question, we had to really dig into how does insulin signaling mediate the alternative states, and how are they regulating the pathways that control aging, or can slow aging? And the approach we chose to use from this was to follow FOXO, the transcription factor that is regulated by insulin. So even though I and many others would just show you insulin signaling going to FOXO is a signaling pathway, it really is a network. And this is just a gross simplification of a network. It involves MAP kinase pathways, the TOR pathway, which is involved in local nutrient sensing, is even feedback from TOR towards repression of the insulin signaling pathway. The insulin signaling pathway insulin leads to the repression of FOXO. You take insulin away, FOXO becomes activated. And this is a transcription factor that can both induce and repress genes. One of the genes it represses, just to make this network more interesting, is 4-ABP, which is studied here by Deborah Kimbrell, which is repressed by TOR. This is the translation pathway. So you can see this is interesting and complicated, because insulin signaling might regulate aging through FOXO, but it might regulate aging because it goes through TSC and it comes out to regulate translation. We don't know. Well, the suggestion, at least in C. elegans, is that it requires DAF16, because mutants of DAF16, double mutants in DAF2, are not long-lived. So we did the same experiment in Drosophila, but it took us a lot longer because we had to work with outbred flies, make them all co-lysogenic and stuff like that. We finally got the, this is 2011, this took us a while to get out. Here we're working with the insulin receptor substrate homolog called Chico, because these flies make it worse, and FOXO as double mutants. The wild type is this one here. The Chico heterozygote is a beautifully long-lived fly, nicely reproducible, great genotype to work with. If we make a double mutant with FOXO, though, its lifespan goes back towards normal. One caveat here is that the FOXO mutant itself has a slightly shorter lifespan. So I don't think that all of the aging regulation can be explained by the epistasis between Chico or insulin signaling and FOXO. I think there's other players involved. But at least some of it, of this effect here upstream, requires this transcription factor, FOXO, right here. And it makes it worthwhile then to pursue the question, okay, what is FOXO doing to extend lifespan, or insulin signaling, because when we knock it down, FOXO becomes activated. The first way we approached this, and actually this is older data before we understood the epistasis, but we just trusted it would work out, was we overexpressed FOXO using standard Drosophila techniques in specific tissues using a conditional expression system where there's a binary GAL4 UAS, but the GAL4 only works if you give them RU46. So you can have flies that are normal, the same genotype, you feed them RU46 and you get the overexpression of the gene that you're interested in. So I'll be using this quite a bit, plus or minus RU. And the place that we discovered worked, and we tried lots of different drivers, was fat body. If we overexpress in just these blue stained tissues only in the adult, we would get a result that looked like this. And we could do this dose dependently even. The green one is overexpression of FOXO. The broken line is wild type. This is a high level of overexpression. Here's a lower level of overexpression. So FOXO is sufficient to extend lifespan. But the interesting thing about this, and I just showed you, is like, well, wait a minute. You're only manipulating it in the fat body. And as a matter of fact, in this particular experiment, only the fat body in the head. So that's the brain. And this is fat body that's kind of interdigitating with the brain. And those are the eyes right there. That's the only place we did this manipulation. The rest of the body, we're not overexpressing FOXO. Yet we get a whole phenotype from the whole body, which is a long-lived fly. What this means is that insulin signaling is non-autonomous. It must be affecting some other hormone, I presume, that's going to be regulating the lifespan, because I've only messed around with this little bit of tissue here. So what's integrating and controlling the lifespan of the whole fly? It turns out the secondary hormone is insulin, again. So insulin is its own secondary message. The way we discovered this was Meng Ping, who was working on this at the time, dissected the fat body out of the abdomen, which is miles away from the head. And then we did immunocytochemistry with antibodies against FOXO, and in the absence of RU46 affecting the head expression, FOXO is in the cytoplasm. But when we activated the head fat body FOXO, we found FOXO went into the nucleus, the nuclei, in the distant fat body of the abdomen. And there's only one way we knew this could happen, was if the abdominal fat body was actually perceiving or seeing low levels of insulin. It's as if the head fat body was somehow controlling the systemic levels of insulin secretion. And that turns out to be exactly what's happening. Remember I showed you from that cartoon earlier that the insulin is being produced in the brain. So these are the adult brain IPC stained with antibody against insulin. And we're, now what we're doing here is we're measuring with quantitative PCR the levels of three of the four insulins that are made in these cells. And when we induce FOXO in the head fat body, it reduces the level of DILP2, one of the insulins in the brain, just one of them. These don't get affected. So this would suggest then that this tissue is going to be secreting less insulin of this particular type, and that might explain this phenotype, it might explain aging. Well, it could be doing other things, it could be regulating juvenile hormone. So what we did was we knocked out all of these cells. Well, these cells might actually do produce other hormones besides insulin. So we knocked these out using an ablation construct, and we got this outer green line here, long-lived relative to the white ones. This inner green line is the same data, but is confounded by age-independent effects. The real data that we need to pay attention to is this outer one. So these insulin-producing cells are sufficient to control lifespan, suggesting that the fat body in the head controls insulin secretion from the brain, and that is sufficient to control lifespan in the fly. But then again, maybe it's some other hormone, and insulin's regulating that. This is a perennial problem in aging research with insulin. So how can we tell that the patterns of aging that we see are because all the cells in the body that have to maintain their somatic function are actually being affected by insulin? Or is it really just the insulin is regulating, you know, in ecdysone, juvenile hormone, or in mammals, some other hormone that we're unaware of, something in activin or inhibin, something like that is actually regulating the lifespan of the flies, progesterone and growth hormone. It's a hard problem. And the way you have to address this actually is to stop actually just looking at demography, which is what I've been doing, and look at functional aging of specific tissues where you can manipulate the insulin signaling just in those tissues at an autonomous level. And to do that was serendipity. It came with the traveling sort of thing that I was teaching a course at Michigan for postdocs and grad students on aging, and while I was there, I met R.J. Wessels, who was the postdoc at the time of Rolf Bodmer, who happened to be in France on vacation at the time, so we called him up and said, we've got this idea. Because what these guys were doing was working on fly hearts, and they had noticed that if you take fly hearts and you put flies on basically an electronic treadmill, stimulate them, as they get older, the hearts fail at higher and higher rates. And I said, that's really cool. Is this regulated by insulin? And can we use this as a model of functional aging at a tissue level that might be able to get at some of the questions about autonomous and non-autonomous control? So we did this experiment where we manipulated the insulin IGF of the whole fly, and this is a control wild type, and if we take a mutant that's got insulin receptor mutants throughout the whole body, for instance, they don't have as big an increase with age. So that seemed to say, yes, insulin signaling can control this functional aging. But the real question, and the best part of the paper, I think, is in the last panel here. What we did here is we manipulated insulin IGF signaling only in the heart tissue. This fly has normal insulin signaling everywhere. It makes insulin, it's got patent receptors, but in the heart itself, if we reduce insulin signaling, that preserves the youthfulness of the heart function, saying, yeah, the target tissues are actually responsive to this low insulin, and therefore that probably is indeed the somatic controller of aging in the insulin signaling mutants. So the intermediate model then that we could come up with at this point is there's two parts to insulin signaling and aging. There's a system between fat body and the brain, and then the brain produces insulin and that goes into peripheral tissue, suppresses FOXO and regulates all these other functions. Let's say heart, gonad, abdominal fat body, and that regulates the aging output. Here, if insulin is produced, that activates a receptor that represses FOXO, and big question mark, somehow this is happening in cells within the fat body. This communicates with the brain. Well, if FOXO is not being produced, that releases this negative suppression, so this becomes a self-sustaining positive feedback loop. But as I'll show you later, we can flip it. If we take out insulin here, this turns on, and then that represses. So it's a self-sustaining negative feedback loop. So this is a feedback system, and here's the peripheral aging. Insulin's playing a role in both places. But it leaves us still with the question, this would be like the last segment of data, it's a little dense, is, well, great. What is FOXO? Like I said, let's follow FOXO. And we've gotten to this point, but we still don't know what FOXO is doing. What are the targets of FOXO that slows heart aging or any other tissue that has a somatic degeneration that needs to be maintained? Or what are the targets of FOXO that's involved in the signal from fat body to the brain? And there's two ways that we've approached this. The first is really exciting, but I can't go into it because it's still preliminary, but it's coming along nicely. Is what we've done is we've used chromatin immunoprecipitation with sequencing of the targets using FOXO as our target, the antibodies to FOXO. So we take flies that are insulin mutants, we precipitate the chromatin with FOXO bound to the sites that are activated because of the low insulin signaling, and then we fish those out and we sequence where the FOXO is binding to describe the targets that FOXO is activating or actually repressing that's associated with extended lifespan. And when we find these, and we've got some nice candidates, we go back to the molecular genetics and just manipulate those downstream of FOXO and try to do the epistasis to prove it's causal. It's a long process. So we took a shortcut for the Hua says, I want an easy short project. Yeah, this one took 2 years. We went by precedence. So I've told you that insulin is produced in the brain of adult flies. But in larvae, most of it's produced in the brain. Turns out, though, that one of the insulins, called DILP6, is produced in fat body. So these two papers showed that. And they also showed that FOXO binds to, and here's the binding sites in DILP6. So it's a very nice molecular mechanism that FOXO is activating DILP6 in larval fat body. So what we decided to do, Hua and I, was to say, okay, what happens in adults? Where's DILP6 in adults? We didn't actually know at the time. So just a little bit of PCR, and you can see fat body, it's very high. This says head carcass, but it's got a lot of head fat body. There's a little bit in the brain. But compare this to DILP 1, 2, 3, and 5. These are all in the brain and almost no other tissue. So DILP6 is expressed in lots of places that the other insulins are not made. And as people suspected for the larval fat body, we can show that DILP6 is regulated by the same sorts of cues. One of them is feeding. If we fast the flies, take the food away, DILP6 goes up in the fat body. Notice, you think, okay, take the food away, insulin should go down. That's what happens in mammals. Well, DILP5 goes down, not 2, but 5 goes down in the brain, 6 goes up in the fat body. And as they showed for larvae, DILP6 is regulated by FOXO. So if we overexpress FOXO in fat body, either the head or the abdomen, we increase DILP6 message. So express FOXO, increase DILP6 message. This should start to sound a bit familiar. We showed you before, I showed you that if you overexpress FOXO in fat body, top panel, you extend lifespan. And now we're saying FOXO is upstream of DILP6. So we ask the question, does overexpressing DILP6 itself in fat body, this is increased insulin signaling, not decreased, increased insulin, extend lifespan? And it does. That's what's happening right here, the black circles relative to the white ones. And then we could do the epistasis. This is kind of cool because now we have RNAi. So just in fat body, we can overexpress FOXO, but simultaneously, because it's a UAS construct, we can knock down DILP6 using RNAi. So drive FOXO, but knock down DILP6, and there's no difference in lifespan between the control and the manipulated genotype, showing epistatically that DILP6 is downstream of the FOXO overexpression, and that might be one more step in the pathway that's leading to longevity extension. Well, how would this work? We're almost back to like where we started from. Oh, great. So we're overexpressing FOXO in fat body. Yeah, great. It works through DILP6. Is this similar to what we found before with FOXO in fat body that's functioning through insulin signaling in the brain? It is. When we drive DOPE-6, now here I'm using head, fat, body, because that's how this experiment happened to work out. And we now look in the abdominal fat body for ABP, which is our target of FOXO. So we're using this as a proxy for FOXO activation. It's activated, suggesting that there's low insulin signaling. If we measure the insulin signaling or the insulin message from the brain, it's reduced, DOPE-2 and DOPE-5. So that looks familiar. And then what Hua has been able to do most recently, and this is really satisfying, is that we can now go to the level of protein. We can measure circulating insulin in the bloodstream of the hemolymph of the flies. But this is looking at the IPCs in the brain. We overexpress in the abdominal fat body. It's definitely reduced DOPE-2, maybe 5. This is the message, this is the fluorescence for that. But the part I like the best, as you can see here, the hemolymph DOPE-2 is strongly repressed when we overexpress DOPE-6. So the fat body is making one kind of insulin, and the brain is reducing another kind of insulin. And the net effect in the fly is they're experiencing less insulin signal. So the last model to put this together is, these pieces have been coming along, so it's not that hard to digest. It's like I showed you before. But what we can tell you now is the FOXO, one way we think it's communicating to the IPCs is through DOPE-6. We don't know if DOPE-6 itself is being secreted from the fat body and acting as an adipokine, or if it's regulating some other protein that's an adipokine, or possibly changing the metabolism, and there's a metabolic feedback to the brain. All these are possibilities. And it's still possible, too, that FOXO has other controls to the DOPE-2 in the brain. But again, this is the insulin regulatory circuit. And this controls then the secretion, we can show this now, of DOPE-2 into the hemolymph. And this will then regulate FOXO in peripheral tissues that will regulate stress resistance and longevity assurance. And the other work with the chromatin IP of these FOXOs is tracking down what these targets are in FOXO in other tissues that control their aging and their persistence. Why I like this, in a sense, and I looked at this and went, this is crazy, but it actually fits into some theory that's coming out in network analysis and transcription, is where the theory's being worked out, called bistable theory, or bistable alternate states. You can have these feed-forward systems like right here, and what this does is it puts the animal in one kind of a valley, let's say in a reproductive pro-aging valley, and it won't be perturbed very easily to slow down reproduction and to turn on longevity assurance, because as long as the insulin's being produced, it stops this repressive system. But if there's a switch that can somehow break this circuit, photoperiod, some sort of a stress, I don't know, and it stops, let's say, the insulin production here, that will weaken this signal, and then FOXO will become activated, and then that will reinforce this and turn this down. So the system can go from one stable state to another stable state, which will be longevity assurance. Once the insulin levels are reduced, less is secreted into the hemolymph, and then you've got activated FOXO that gives you this state right here. So this physiology is being integrated by insulin and insulin IGF and FOXO, and I think it's leading to these alternate torpor states or all plasticity in life history. Which brings me to just a few closing slides. And I'm funded by NIH, so this is always a non-trivial question. When I give talks at medical schools and stuff, people say, that's really interesting, but what does this have to do with humans, you know? These guys, these women, these are model systems. We didn't talk about mice, but there's someplace in between. How do we relate insulin signaling and torpor ideas to humans? And there's two or three key questions for this that I think we're just beginning to get our hands on. The first one is, can there be this plasticity for longevity assurance in the absence of torpor? Here's a famous case of torpor in humans, but it was science fiction. We don't do this. We don't know how to do this. Maybe we can never do this. But we clearly don't. We don't have diapause and hibernation. So what's the relevance then of this diapause hibernation concept to humans if we don't have an insulin signaling, if we can't do this kind of behavior? I don't have the full answers for this, but I'm going to try to give you some clues that actually might work. But the more relevant question that I often get, and this came up in some of the conversations today, is that people say, I don't get it. You've shown us mutants of insulin receptors. They're nulls. Well, maybe they're not nulls. They're hypermorphs. But your bugs are insulin resistant. They have low insulin signaling. That's what everyone calls it, reduced insulin signaling, low insulin signaling. To me, as a physician or clinician will say, that's insulin resistance, that's diabetes, that's disease. So how can reduced insulin signaling be beneficial? Or how do you, it's the signs opposite. I mean, how do you relate that to humans when the same kind of conditions lead to metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance, and all the things that go with it? We don't really know the answer to this, but here's how I'm approaching it. We've been screening through a collection of non-co-isogenic single nucleotide substitutions that were generated by different methods in the insulin receptor of Drosophila. And we used, because of the nature of the material, we used a quantitative genetic method called quantitative complementation testing. The bottom line in this is we were able to identify a number of new mutants that extend lifespan in Drosophila. These are the ones in red. But these are all heterallelic against the same combination I showed you earlier, this E19. All these other mutants make viable adults. They're either short-lived or have no effect on aging, but they're all dwarfs. All these mutants make small flies. So you can see the specificity. Only these mutants that affect in the kinase domain extend lifespan. All these other mutants make small flies. We think that what we're finding is a qualitative change in the receptor that's associated with longevity. It's not just the receptor's broken or insensitive or has less signaling. The idea that I want to pursue is that it has different signaling. And what we'd like to figure out is what do these mutants do to the structure and due to the biochemistry and due to the signaling of the receptor that is qualitatively different, not just quantitatively different. And here's the last piece, and this kind of goes back to the torpor concept and the relevance to humans. People are beginning to discover, and an IGF receptor, this people, a person in Russian Sue with Einstein, there are polymorphisms in the IGF receptor that are enriched in centenarians. So just like I was showing you for the insulin receptor in the fly, there's specific single nucleotide substitutions that are correlated with exceptional lifespan. One of the things we'd like to do is to put these mutants from here into the fly and see if they're sufficient to extend lifespan. But the point for now is, hey, it's the same system, perhaps the same kinds of mutants. So humans do have polymorphisms and the capacity possibly for insulin signaling to regulate lifespan. We might not have torpor, we might have the same longevity assurance phenotype, but it's expressed just at a genetic level. Another place where a lot of polymorphisms are showing up and multiple repeated reports in association studies I'm quite excited about is in the FOXO. So humans with FOXO polymorphisms also can be centenarians, and this is a highly repeatable result over different populations. So translating this to humans, if I could, I'd say that slow aging occurs when there's functional changes in the insulin receptor that are qualitatively different. They're not necessarily insensitive, they're just different. And the insulin resistance paradox is because of this alternative physiology. It's not a disease physiology. And humans, I think, actually exhibit nucleotide polymorphism that's similar to what we may be able to induced by mutants in flies, could exist in natural populations as well. And we can go back and forth between the two systems by introducing those mutants into flies and seeing what they do. So the question that we're trying to pursue now, okay, after 15, 20 years of work to bring you up and where we're going in the future, is to try to ask, what's the nature of the change in insulin signaling that assures longevity? We have all these different model systems. Didn't talk about these. It's knockout mice, IGF mice, IRS mice, and polymorphisms in humans. And I'd like to know, what's the conserved common mechanism among them that provides longevity assurance. This cartoon came out, was actually stimulated by the discovery by Seymour Benzer with the Methuselah. And Booth thought that was pretty funny, that they're, you know, working on aging flies. She's telling this guy who couldn't care less, right? Scientists have extended the lifespan of the fruit fly. Here's a scientist that I've worked with over the years doing that, and I'd like to thank them, and thank you for your attention.
When do we get the lights? Is there any
lights now? I'm working on that.
Okay. So, we have questions here?
Okay, sure.
So, what about quality of life for the fruit fly?
Yes.
It's a topic.
It's important. So we're working on a number of those characteristics now. The mutants with the reduced insulin signaling are much better. They fly really well when they're old, and wild type flies don't. And you don't even have to have fancy equipment to do this. You pick up a cage of Chico mutants that are 50 days old, and it's like popcorn. These guys are all over the place. You pick up a cage of wild types, and the few that are left are just kind of hanging out on the bottom. But it's other stuff, too. We were beginning to work on olfaction. That also declines with age, and these mutants rescue that. So I think there's a lot of, and we're working on innate immunity as well. So we're trying to make these anthropomorphic models about quality of life and functional systems that have direct medical relevance. And they do a good job.
In your ultimate, your slide there with the three different boxes in it,
yep.
I was a little confused. So you have reduced.
This one?
Yeah, there, yeah. So you've got reduced insulin signaling in the first two boxes. What's the insulin sensitivity in the periphery? What's the actual, if you give a certain dose of insulin, what's the responsiveness of those peripheral tissues? Is it reduced or increased?
I don't know. It's something that we could do at this point. We have to do an ex vivo assay, take the tissue out, stimulate it, measure AKT, the kinetics of AKT phosphorylation. I'm predicting that it will be on some portions of the signaling, it might be reduced, and other portions it might be strengthened. So, as I was telling you when we talked, is that let's say maybe the AKT axis would be reduced, but maybe the MAP kinase would be increased, and so it would be behaving more like an IGF receptor than an insulin receptor. But we haven't done those experiments yet. Okay. Yes, Julie, here.
Okay, so what do you think the contribution of oxidative stress is to tissue senescence and lifespan? I mean, that's a big controversy in the field, and you didn't talk about it today.
That's right, I didn't talk about
it. I thought it was a big, kind of question.
That's because I don't know. I don't know, and I don't think anybody else really does either. So in flies, people have tried overexpressing SOD, catalase, this, that. The data is completely equivocal. I see lots of data and lots of arguments about it. They go, yeah, it looks good, but I think it's really hard to prove that it's causal. As opposed to just an ancillary thing that's happening. Yes?
Do human centenarians tend to have reduced fecundity? Like, is there anything that?
That was a mixed bag on that. I mean, so that there's they have late onset menopause. They tend to live longer. I mean, there's some evidence there. And so, in other words, they're fertile later in life.
Yeah.
And so,
right. So they maintain their reproductive lifespan longer.
Yeah.
There's different data from different people saying they have their total fecundity is more or less. I think that's equivocal.
Yeah. No, that's pretty big. So I have a question.
Yes.
So you know, there's 300 theories of aging, literally, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, where does yours fit in? Is this a new one, or is this a refinement of the existing one?
I didn't say anything about a theory of aging.
Okay. So
there's no. This is about the regulation of
Okay, so how does it fit into the an existing theory of aging?
I would say it's probably consistent with almost all of them, because what it's, but because what it's talking about is that the theories of aging are all trying to talk about what happens at the somatic level that goes wrong. And what I'm just saying is that's plastic, and the degeneration might take place in one of 300 ways. There's repair mechanisms for each one of them, and they can be regulated. The repair mechanisms can be turned on, or the damage mechanisms can be accelerated. And I don't know what those are. I don't know if it's, you know, reactive oxygen species, if it's mitochondria, if it's DNA damage. You know? So what I'm looking at is kind of overarching. But the thing that's striking is when people do mutagenic studies, this is the system that keeps, you know, worms and flies and mice. This is the system that keeps coming up as regulating the lifespan, because that's the phenotype we're looking at.
So another question. So you're on, you serve on these panels, review grants right at the frontiers of aging. I mean, where is aging science? And I mean, is there some breakthrough on the horizon where, you know, getting back to your medical colleagues and so forth, I mean, where there, in the next 20 years, is there going to be any big breakthrough that would, improve health span and lifespan as well? What do you see as the big questions there that are going to be answered?
Yes.
There will
I think there's going to be. I think it's going to be pharmacology. That when there are going to be drugs discovered that mimic or reduce these systems without negative side effects. And we might not even know what they're doing. I mean, we'll use resveratrol as an example, where it was discovered by screening some sort of reporter, presumably of SIRT2 activation. And in a lot of well-done experiments, resveratrol is sufficient to extend lifespan. So the thought is, oh, because it's activating SIRT2. We did experiments in mutant flies without SIRT2 and didn't activate it. But the point is, I think resveratrol actually does lots of things besides SIRT2, and it extends lifespan. We might not know the pathway it's working through just because that's how it was found. So I think people are going to be screening drugs using proxies like this on molecular mechanisms, even because it's more efficient that way. And then we're going to find stuff that works, but we won't know how.
We could get resveratrol to work in our flies. But was it Sinclair? He sold his company for $7 million. So obviously he knew something we didn't. Maybe one or two more questions, and then we'll call it an evening.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I know this doesn't directly have anything to do with anything, but do you know what's going on with fungi that you don't seem to synapse?
No. There are people, and some of them are here, who study, you know, fungi. And there's different kinds of fungi, right? You know, there's Saccharomyces, and then there's Palumbi, and some. But the mechanism's there, and I can't address that.
Maybe one more? Anybody?
Hi, Annie.
I have to ask you about natural variation, of course.
Yeah.
So now that you have a pretty good idea of sort of how the circuit works, then if you go back into like Paul Schmidt's clients of natural variation and diet laws, where do you think the natural variation is? And how does that translate into longevity? Is it, am I making sense?
Yep.
And like actually ask the follow-up question that way.
Well, okay, so I, you know, going back to Paul Schmidt's stuff, is I think the natural variation is going to be and there's sensitivity to environmental cues that induce this. So it's even upstream of insulin signaling. It's going to be in the neuronal circuits that perceive photoperiod, humidity, food quality, all this stuff that just determines if this gets switched one way or the other. And that, you know, we know there's a lot of natural variation in the insulin receptor. And I can now, with homologous recombination, go start asking which of these are relevant. But my guess is that the variation that matters is going to be way upstream. Yeah, in the environmental cue sensitivity and the neuronal circuits that control this.
Thank you. And then, has anybody looked at, either in humans or in flies or anything, just looked for like sequence signatures of sweet to balancing selection or anything at any of these loci found by GWAS in humans? Or, I mean, would you have a prediction about that? Should there be balancing selection for some of these things? Because
probably. Yeah. We've looked at flies. You know, we did this with David, and Paul's done it with Annalise. And there's apparently a lot of balance in selection in the insulin receptor. But one of the issues might be because it's so pleiotropic. Yeah.
Okay, maybe we better wrap it up. But we have a little plaque for Mark here. He's running on fumes. We started early this morning. So
actually, we have three things for Mark. The first one is we will be etching his name in a plaque that we have in the Department of Entomology in the main hallway. It'll be there forever as a Tom and Nina Lee Distinguished Alumni Speaker. The second thing, and maybe it's the most important, is actually an honorarium, and it is a $500 honorarium, so it's not insignificant. And again, that's made possible by a very generous gift from Tom and Nina Lee. And the third one, that's very nice, and may actually only serve as a dust collector, but let me get it out here.
An umbrella. Oh, that is nice.
Actually, it's a very nice plaque for Mark.
Thank
so.
You. That's great. I've been trying to get trophies in bike racing all these years, but finally, what I'm really good at.
And I really appreciate everyone coming. It was a great seminar. I'm sure everyone learned a lot. So, again, let's thank Mark for a fantastic presentation. Get a picture of the three of us.
Yeah, okay.
Sure. Yeah.